Welcome to the podcast Typical Yoast, powered by On It Now. A unique collaboration between leading ITSM specialists, InfraVision, Yoast IT, and Mproof. We talk with thought leaders from the IT service management tooling industry. I am Stefan Leij, a partner at Yoast IT. In this episode, I'll be talking to Julie Moore, a principal analyst at Forrester.
I think what we want to have is organizations that are really positively investing in their people to make that transition.
We'll be discussing the criteria of the Forrester Wave and how it can work for startups. What does AI mean for the service management industry in terms of workplaces and customer conversations? We'll also explore the darker side of the impact of technology. Listen in for 38 minutes. Welcome, Julie, in this nice location in the Netherlands, in Harmelen, as we say. You're principal analyst at Forrester. And, well, maybe the first question for our listeners as well, what is the Forrester Wave report?
The Forrester Wave is an analysis of vendors in a particular industry. In the case of the ESM-ITSM wave that I just completed, it's looking at those vendors who have met a criteria to be included. First of all, it starts with a landscape where we look at the general field. And then we have inclusion criteria where we look at a certain set of those vendors and evaluate them with rigorous questions and criteria to understand exactly how they perform in areas that we think are important in our industry, as well as to Forrester clients.
And those criteria, what are they based on? I don't know the criteria exactly, but what's the basis for those criteria?
So for this particular wave, I am doing it after two of my colleagues did it 2 years ago. So Charlie Betts and Will McKinnon-White developed that criteria. And rather than completely make up my own criteria, I took what they had and then looked at where we've gone in the industry over the last 2 years and added some more on trying to differentiate the leaders in this space in some key attributes around work collaboration, how far it expands. For example, is it connecting into the DevOps world, and is it working in the business space? So lots of different criteria, just as a measure to understand how it meets client expectations.
Yeah, because the reason why also interested in those criteria is, for example, I'm a startup. I start with a new service management tool. What do I need to do to get into the Wave report? Because, well, it's new technology and it's rapidly evolving, those technology. And in the Wave, I think, are the most common vendors probably described. Am I correct, or how do you?
Yeah, well, we start with the landscape report. So it's really the analyst's responsibility to go out there and look at the vendors in that space.
Yeah.
Typically, analysts come into the firm with already a strength of background in a particular area. So for me, I've been working in IT service management for 20 plus years. And so I already had a really good understanding of the vendors that were in that space, but I did my due diligence.
Yeah.
If it's a startup though, it especially if it's in EMEA where I may not have as much exposure, it's very helpful if the company goes and does a briefing. They can, contact Forrester and set up a briefing, and then they can not only tell us about the product, but also introduce us to the company, where they are in their journey. And then, we'll schedule enough time to make sure that we get a demo and see how the product works. Once we're aware, then, landscape, right now I'm not even close to the number of vendors that are allowed. So, there's room for introducing new vendors into that space. But the landscape is really meant to narrow that list down to the ones that are most likely to be used by,
Is it a crowded space?
That would be hard for me to say, since this is the very first wave I've done and I really have not gone through the process with someone else to know that, comparison to other waves. But we do see quite a few startups. One of the criteria that I had for the wave this year was that the company had to make $100 million or more. I was very interested in trying to separate the space at the top, finding ways to distinguish those vendors that had, you know, a substantial presence in the market. I'm not sure I'll do that again. It left off some vendors that I know, you know, have good products and would have been valuable to have in the wave. But, you know, you have to somehow narrow down the list. I couldn't figure out how to do it other than based on revenue and applicable force to clients.
Yeah, of course, because you cannot analyze everything. I understand that. But that's the negative side of a criteria is that, well, maybe they're below the criteria, very interesting tools. And they're not mentioned in the wave, but I can imagine that it's a difficult thing to look at.
It is, and I think in my case, we have this balance. So you can ask more questions, but you can't have as many vendors.
No,
you can have more vendors, you can't ask as many questions, and that's because it's sheerly the amount of time and effort that it takes to go through a wave. For you to do your due diligence on every single one of the companies and to keep all those details in your head, we have to limit it in some way.
Yeah.
So this time I chose to go with fewer vendors, but I also introduced new criteria that had not been in the wave previously. So
okay. Can you mention some?
I did. We're talking about work collaboration.
Okay. Yeah.
For example, work collaboration, the IT service management platforms are being adopted within the business areas. Yeah. And we've kind of labeled that enterprise service management. And because of that adoption, we are now seeing business data, IT data, and if we also connect to the developer world, developer data.
Yeah.
And so I really wanted to know how the vendors were thinking about work collaboration. And I don't mean, you know, we have a workflow for onboarding a new employee where tasks go to HR and some to facilities and IT. That's not collaboration, that's activity and task management as part of a workflow. So I wanted to know how they were helping teams collaborate, how they were helping teams understand end-to-end service management, giving them the whole value stream, maybe giving someone in development side, more visibility into the customer, you know, IT, more visibility into what's going on in development, so that we're better aware and better prepared to work collaboratively across teams.
Yeah. What did you just said that you, I think 2 years now you took over from Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
What was the most surprising thing if you look at your research and at the Wave report, what you read or saw, what you didn't know before?
Honestly, I didn't know anything about the vendors before I started.
Okay.
As an independent consultant, you're meant to be vendor neutral.
Yeah.
If my client wanted help with choosing a product, I would help them develop their requirements, prioritize those, and then help them go through the process of evaluating and choosing a tool, but I was never a systems integrator. So whenever it came time for the implementation, you know, my services were no longer needed.
Right.
So coming into the wave, I knew nothing about these products. And in fact, I think it probably shocked some of the vendors like, you don't know about us? No, I don't know anything about your product.
Okay.
But honestly, I don't think I could have ever gathered the amount of information that I now know without having gone through that process.
Okay.
It is labor intensive, but boy, I mean, coming out of it, I'm like, wow, I know. Okay. Now I want to ask them this question. And you know, you go on a blackout where you're not allowed to have any contact with the vendors outside of the wave process.
Okay.
And so they continue innovating and sending out press releases and stuff, but I'm not allowed to, you know, have a conversation with them. So now
it's a very strict process
incredibly strict.
Yeah.
And so now that I'm, you know, the wave has been published early November, I can now
can
have contact, right? And so it's like, I want to know more about what's been going on. I mean, I started this in May, April timeframe.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's a long time to not have contact with those vendors.
Three quarters of a year. And that's each time, it's every 2 years, or what's the wave frequency?
The wave frequency is generally up to the analyst. There's no mandated requirement that I update it in 2 years. That's just the likely cycle.
Yeah.
The waves take, you know, a lot of, they're resource intensive, not just for the analyst, but for the entire Forrester ecosystem, plus the entire ecosystem of every vendor.
Yeah.
In fact, I can remember as I'm going through the process just saying, thank you so much for all the time and effort, because I can't imagine what it's like to take a script that someone else wrote and try to meet all of those criteria and demonstrate what the product does, but they all did that. So it's a lot of work on everybody. You don't want to do it too often.
No.
You have to do it often enough that you're able to catch those new capabilities. Something like generative AI had just hit. And, you know, vendors were all over the roadmap on where they were in their journey of evaluating and adding the functionality. There wasn't a lot of live capability. You know, now that it's finished, I'm pretty sure many of those vendors have got that functionality. So our clients are going to want to know, you know, what are they doing with generative AI? And we need to be able to evaluate that. So it'll happen again in around 2 years, and we'll see where the market is at that time.
Well, you're talking about AI, so let's go into that that topic as well. What does AI mean for the industry? Is it really a game changer?
So I'll start with AI.
Yeah. What is AI?
Without the generative side of that, one of the things that provides to operational organizations is the ability to take things that happen frequently, which is what often happens in operations, whether it's monitoring, taking phone calls, you know, answering questions. There's a lot of repetitive work, repetitive maintenance that we do. And it has a way not just automating it, but to put a level of intelligence in the process. And that can only happen with large volumes of data, which are also, you know, if you're a smaller organization, you're not going to get as much benefit, but the larger the organization, the better. So things like determining the routing. Routing has always been a problem with operations. Yeah. Oh, we think it goes to this team. We'll just send it, right? And so being smart about that, you know, the system can say, hey, with this categorization and these keywords that are within a record, its most likely destination should be, you know, X. So it can help to improve the judgment of the human in the loop based on repetition. So it can also do things like auto recovery, help with problem analysis to the point where you can isolate the root cause more easily, because it's looking again at patterns and things that have happened in the past. So in general, AI is a very positive thing to add into the operational environment. I think we don't necessarily have the skill sets in our industry for doing that successfully. You know,
is that really disrupting? Is it, we were going to work totally different? And it helps us.
I think if I were to look at it purely from the human side, there are some things that will be automated that we're probably very happy if we never had to do again. I look at something like event correlation. The ability to identify incidents, to be more proactive. These are things that humans have had a really tough time doing. We can look at the tickets and we can try to find patterns, but it requires a lot of time.
And the more of the data to,
which we don't have, because we're under the, you know, constantly getting new calls and new incidents coming in. We don't have a lot of time to dedicate to that analysis. Throw AI at that problem. You know, the time is inconsequential, and, you know, even if it comes up with something that's partially correct, it's probably something we would not have gotten to because we didn't have the time to do it from a human perspective. So absolutely, it's making what we do in service management better. You know, everything from chatbots to, you know, there's a lot of good intelligence layers that we can add into IT operations that, definitely enables us to be more efficient, more productive.
Yeah. Now, but that's also on things that currently we can't do, we now can do. And things that we repetitive do that goes faster or...
do better or not have to do at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And spend our time on different things.
The generative AI brings in a whole new level of capability.
Yeah.
You know, if I look back at my career and I can say this
with ChatGPT
I could say this with great confidence. I have talked to a lot of IT people, and even though I have an IT degree, I can tell you I have not understood every conversation that I've had. No. The conversational side of things in IT is, you know, there are people that are really good at communication that are in IT, and I think they really excelled and became relationship, kind of managing the relationship between business and IT because they could talk with both communities.
Yeah.
That happens to be where I position myself. Even though I was a programmer, I couldn't stand being in a room by myself. Oh. So,
I recognize that.
But, you know, when you're, you look at something like generative AI, for example, I need to send a response to a customer. You know, what I might type in a response may sound very geeky. It may have words that the client doesn't understand. You know, within a click of a button, an engineered prompt can make it sound like it has more empathy or, you know, based upon the type of customer that we know that we're replying to, you can make it more understood, right? Yeah. You can say, write this technical content so a five-year-old can understand it, right? The little things and ways in which we can change our interactions with our customers. I'm doing an experiment right now that I'm writing a report on. About 10 years ago, I built a bot. I called it Sherlock. I mean, I did the whole thing by myself. I installed it. I wrote all about the entire process of installing it and training it. And, you know, while it was an impressive technology, the amount of time that I as an individual had to spend to match intents to responses was crazy. Yeah. And I could never anticipate the type of questions, even though I said this bot is only here to answer questions about knowledge management. I could not get it trained to a level where it could answer questions without me going in and accurately tying the intents to the responses.
You had to do your the translation of the question to
And you know the schema behind the scenes of your mappings, if you weren't really careful in how you did that, you would have multiple responses matched to multiple or intents to multiple responses. So you had to be very rigorous in your methods and how you did that. And I thought, wow, this is a lot of human effort to make a chatbot.
Yeah.
So I advised, you know, clients to save chat files, things that they could train it on real conversations, because it's a lot easier with real conversations than trying to make stuff up. So I decided, hey, I'm going to repeat this process. I'm going to use the exact same data set that I used 10 years ago, but I'm going to use ChatGPT. And within 5 minutes, this thing was up and running. And the difference was night and day.
Yeah.
I could ask a question, it would answer it in one and it would answer it in the other. And I could confirm that the answer was correct. But the conversation, the conversational element was so fine-tuned. It felt like a better answer. Even though there was an answer in there that was pretty prescriptive, it was able to bring that and humanize it. I know that sounds really weird, but it made it more listenable, more easy to understand.
Yeah.
I was able to ask it questions that I knew was not in the data. And because I had pointed it to a couple websites, it was able to answer questions quite intelligently as well. It was able to cite where it pulled the information from. So the, just within, you know, 10 minutes, I had something that had completely replaced a year and a half of working and training, and the product was far superior.
Yeah.
So, you know, and again, very narrow scope, but when you start thinking about how generative AI can help IT operations, Things like any conversational element is going to be improved. Anytime we need to
knowledge articles,
find information, it's going to be better. It's going to be able to search better. And instead of giving us search results, which to my knowledge, I looked at most of the vendors, it just gives you like a list of articles to be able to say, oh, we've looked at all of this and we think this is your answer.
And maybe a combination of different knowledge articles.
That's a whole different level of value, you know, to the human in the loop is getting the answer and not having to open up four or five different records to validate that one worked or, you know, another one didn't.
And bizarre.
I think to me, the generative part of this is also pretty crazy.
That's the game changer.
Yeah. Well, my passion's around knowledge management. So for me, when I start thinking about generative, the ability to create knowledge, I'm typing in an incident record. I click a button and behind there's a script that says, you know, I want you to pull these fields and I want you to put it in this template and I want you to make it a numbered list and I want you to, you know, store that in a knowledge base article. I call that the power of the first draft. Yeah. So it's coming up with something that now I just need to edit to make sure it's okay if I do anything to it. It is hard to get knowledge workers to create knowledge. They say, oh, I don't have time or, you know, it just takes too much effort. So within one button, we've taken away a huge hurdle that can make the organization so much more successful if they captured knowledge. So there's so much we have yet to find with the generative AI, but the early use cases are pretty powerful.
I'm going to skip a little bit to another topic because, we talked that you work for 2 years now at Forrester, and that before we started this podcast, I asked you to think about a song that maybe represents Forrester or the service management market.
Yoast Jukebox.
And you had one in mind, so I'm curious.
It took me a while to think of a song. And this one is probably going to be quite surprising because it's not a happy song.
Okay.
It's a song called Mother Father by Dave Matthews Band.
Mother Father, please explain to me how it could be so this world has come to be. A precious balance in between, such cruelty and such kindness. Please, please, Mother, Father, please explain to me.
Where basically he talks about what has this world become.
Okay.
You know, and all of the things that are occurring. While I'm excited about generative AI, we're also in a very interesting place as a humanity. And while this has a lot of promise, I hear organizations all the time say, oh, we're going to drop people. We're going to let go of people. We're going to replace them with AI. I just wonder, where's the human in all of this? These are people. These are people who know our customers. You know, we don't want to let them go. That's a valuable asset. We want to train them, provide them a path. Make them more productive by using this technology, but not get rid of them. So, you know,
do you see a dark future?
I don't think I can look at it and not think of, you know, the potential for us to go the wrong way. I'm kind of a utopian type of person where, you know, I will always believe in the good in everybody and everyone, but, you know, I know enough about the world to know that it's not always there.
No, but I still compare it with in the 80s, we also had, the desktop computer came and everybody said, okay, now the computer is coming. A lot of labor will go away. But in the end, we have more jobs than people still. So I'm kind of hopeful that this is the same. This will help us enormously, but it will create all kind of other jobs and things that we need to maybe give more attention to our customers because the standard things we don't have to do anymore. But
wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
more white glove service for our customers.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's going to impact the job market. I honestly don't. There is so much right now needed, new skill sets needed in this area. And I don't think that dynamic is going to change much. I think what we want to have is organizations that are really positively investing in their people to make that transition. That I think is really important. But when I look at the overall, again, you know, there's a lot of mal actors that we have out there today doing things to disrupt countries, to disrupt industries. You know, these tools are available to them too, and they're quite powerful tools. So I can't look at it and say, this is all chipper and happy. No. I do know that we're going to have to be very diligent and stay prepared for those mal actors to be using these tools.
If you look at the defenders of IT, you just said it's also important that they or that companies have attention for their employees, etc. Do you look at the Forrester Wave report also at how the vendor is acting as a vendor, not only the technology, but also?
We do have criteria that looks at the vendor within the market, their strategy, their roadmap. You know, what are they doing from an innovation perspective? I did make a comment internally that I kind of felt like we had an obligation to put sustainability as a permanent criteria. And I got some pushback because in certain industries, it wouldn't make sense to have a sustainability. But I'm definitely, because I've looked at some of the vendors in the space and I'm like, wow, you guys are doing that. And it's they're proud of it.
Yeah.
They're often European vendors because there are different rules and regulations here that we may not have. California's unique. That's where I live. We've got every rule around the environment and incentive to get people to do the right thing. But it isn't as progressive in a lot of the rest of the U.S., because but there are a lot of European vendors that are.
I had a few podcasts with vendors, and most of the time they also have sustainability as one of their important strategy for the upcoming years. Also to have employees work at their company and make sure that they stay at their company, but also for customers, it's long, the long term and not the short term. So, it is on their agenda.
You know, my thought around this, and again, this is my own personal feeling, but it is our obligation. We see so much happening, whether you believe in global warming or not, you can't doubt the massive amounts of storms, the changes in weather patterns that we just have not seen. We got to do something. You know, I have children. I want the planet to still be around for them. And to me, it's like, why would we do research in one area and not call it out in another where this is important for us to be thinking about from a technology perspective, especially with generative AI is a huge, huge cost. Not just the cost of compute and the chipsets, but the water for the cooling new data centers being built all over the place. It's having an environmental impact. And, I have been asking vendors, what are you doing about it? What are you doing about it in order to combat that? Because I think we have to have both. We want the good things that come with the new and advanced technology, but we also have to be aware that there is price other than just the price of the compute.
Do you see things changing? Well, we know for a couple of years there are some market leaders. Things going to change in the upcoming years? Is your expectation? Are there runners up? Would you say, okay, well, they're...
In general, you mean to the vendors, or are you still talking about sustainability?
No, sorry, I'm switching to, to vendors.
I kind of see it. There's the leader quadrant where we see a strategy of not just growing market space or market presence, but also growing the footprint within customers. And it's a clear, it's a clear strategy to be tied to a customer. Then you have the more mid-tier vendors that are still at that core IT service management capabilities. I had thought for a while that maybe just doing a wave on those IT service management tools might be helpful, but honestly, we just don't get many inquiries, about those tools. And, for us to justify all that time and effort to do a pure IT service management wave, when we can encapsulate most of those vendors in the other, the ESM wave.
Yeah.
That's the biggest dynamic. I do have to, and this is an important one. The complexity of the platforms is growing. The, mm-hmm. the bigger the footprint. Low code, no code should really yeah. be citizen development. It should be something that you could turn over to a business user and yeah. they can do on their own without needing an engineer. Because you cannot run everything through IT.
No.
And if every single part of the business now needs to go to IT to get a form or to get this or to get that, it's a bottleneck and yeah. it's going to stifle innovation. So I think the vendors really need to begin focusing on limiting complexity.
Zero code.
Yeah, yeah. zero code. Whatever yeah. we got to do yeah. to make these platforms less reliant on IT as the footprint expands. Otherwise, you know, it's not going to be a platform that we're going to want to use and no. be a lot of complaints.
Is there still... what you see in the most of the vendors, well, if you look at enterprise service management, they're not only focusing on IT, but also on broader HR facilities, etc. Is that kind of an end, or do you believe in one tool for all, or do you say, okay, this? I think that it stops there, and you still have certain other domains where other tools are.
It's an interesting question. I don't think I would ever recommend to a client that they go to a single tool.
No.
I think there's too much risk, and I also think the cost constraints would be difficult. Once you become that tied to a vendor, it's really hard for you to complain when they keep cranking the price up for every renewal. You don't really have any leverage. I've had clients come in and say, we can't afford this anymore. We need to move off this platform. And even though we know the cost of switching is going to be excessive.
But in the long term.
In the long term, we have to get off now. And they're asking advice. And I would say, you know, I would move one critical part off, put it into another service, and then use that as a negotiating chip. Say, you know, look, if you don't bring the price down, we can't afford it. We will eventually completely move off your platform. Yeah. I think the vendors think that they're so tied that the client's not going to do it, even if they say they do it. So nothing demonstrates that we're willing to go if you don't, you know, move something off the platform.
Yeah.
I also recommend to clients not to go to a single platform. Not yet. It's the cost. There's a couple dynamics. It's not just that the cost is going up. It's also that internal to the organization, they're leaving this in the IT budget.
Yeah.
So when you start going through the budget process and you look at you're spending $6 million, what, on an IT tool? You know, whatever the cost is, that's a little high, but I thought I'd exaggerate. But when you're spending that kind of money on an IT tool, the business is going to question it.
Yeah.
But when you have a enterprise-wide system, the budget should be enterprise-wide.
Yeah.
So if you're going to be using it in HR and payroll and finance, it should be a line item, their licenses, their portion of the infrastructure costs. Otherwise, you know, we hear all the time clients calling in saying, can you help us? Can you look at this and tell us where can we save money? You know, what can we do to bring the cost down? And unfortunately, there's very little that you can do. So being on one platform really doesn't put you in a position of negotiation.
If I'm a C-level, CIO, whatever, and I want to switch tool, or well, if I don't have a tool, acquire a tool, what would your advice be for my first step?
You know, going through the process, I think the first thing that I would do is to be really certain that your current vendor doesn't have capability. And the reason why I say that is because a lot of times organizations don't update. And so they're on an old version and their impression of the product is really poor. And they decide we're leaving this platform. We're just getting rid of it. We want to move to something new. When that company has a really good product, it is new, and the cost of switching, and you'll get help from that company, would be minimal.
Yeah.
But they're like, oh, the reputation of the product is so bad that, you know, we're not going to stay on this platform. I think that's a big mistake in many cases, because the cost of switching is a lot higher when you go to another vendor. If the product you have doesn't meet your needs, meaning it doesn't have that functionality, I would start with a really good RFI, which means you need to sit down with your different teams and you need to find out what they need in that system. Then you put all those requests together and you sit down in a room and you wait, right? Yeah. The old Moscow analysis of what must we have, should we have, could or won't, that's actually a very valuable way to go into speaking with the vendors.
Yeah.
The vendors are going to tell you a lot of stories.
They're going to do everything. They can do everything.
Everybody can do anything. I know.
What's the best way to go through that? Because if you ask them in an Excel sheet, okay, can you all the requirements? They will answer them all the requirements. They will say yes, we can do it.
Generally, there are some vendors that are more honest, and I usually give them a little bit more weight in the feedback process because they do say, oh, we don't do that. I'd rather have a vendor tell me they don't than they do and then find out later. But once you've narrowed that field, you need to do your due diligence, which means, okay, let's create use cases. Walk us through opening an incident, linking it to a problem, raising a change, walk us through a major incident process. Show us how all of that works. And those use cases should cover your core requirements. That will give you a basis for making a better evaluation once you get down to your short list. Don't trust your vendors. You know, if they say, oh, it's not working today on the system, I'm not sure why, we can get that back to you. No, you'll do another demo.
Yeah.
Because I want to actually see this perform. You know, don't let the sleight of hand in any way, come into play. Ultimately, though, you know, when you shortlist, you've got three vendors that have at least met most of your requirements. A lot of times it comes down to the user interface and it comes down to the presentation skills of the vendor.
Yeah.
I've had really great vendors do really poor on the presentation, and the client says, no way are we buying that product. Vendors need to understand that as well, that if you got a good person that demonstrates the product, they're the right person to put in front of the sales, front of the client.
That's an interesting fact, though, because, and that's my experience exactly, but then customers choose a tool only on the presentation skills. And it's not only, it's a large part of the presentation skills of the person.
If you put yourself in the position of the customer, it's not really, they're not thinking about it as presentation skills. They want to know, does the product do X, Y, Z? That person can communicate it and show it to you.
Yeah.
To them, that's the platform speaking, not the individual.
Yeah.
Me as an analyst, I look at that and go, okay, that's the difference between this person can do a presentation and someone else who can't. But honestly, vendors need to train. They need to have people that are competent in front of the client. You can't.
Well, and vendor fit is also important. That you have that you know that your vendor understands your question and can translate that to a solution in the tool.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for this conversation. I learned a lot as well. And I'm looking forward to it. The WAVE report is out now, I think.
It was published on the 6th of November. Yeah. So just before I got on a plane to come here.
I'm going to read it. So I'm very curious about what's in there. So again, thank you very much also for coming to the Netherlands.
Oh, I see you guys brought the sun out for me.
Yeah, we thought California.
Who needs sun? No, I appreciate coming out here. It's been a wonderful trip. Great people. Yeah.